Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
If you had to pick one word to describe the past couple of months, what would it be? Me, I'd say uncertainty. Uncertainty about the economy and the financial crisis. Uncertainty about how far stocks might fall. Uncertainty about the election, too. Oh, wait. Never mind that last one. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Shriners Hospitals for Children, providing treatment for orthopedic, burn, and spinal cord injuries at no cost to the families. More at ShrinersForKids.org. Sustainability reporting is supported by Johnson Controls, making homes, cars, and workplaces more comfortable, safe, and sustainable. Johnson Controls, where ingenuity is welcome.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you with us on the election, on this election day, rather. It's Tuesday, of course, the 4th of November. And the final election count is not in yet, but Wall Street didn't really much care. Traders took off today on a 305-point run-up on the Dow. The NASDAQ had its sixth straight winning session. I say this with no small amount of reluctance, but there are some really smart people out there who think the stock markets have put the worst of this behind them. That said, nobody is really thinking about stocks tonight, are they? And that's understandable, except we wouldn't want you to miss this. 2 months after Lehman Brothers collapsed and really put the credit markets in the deep freeze, they are now back to something more normal. We sent Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson to find out why.
William Larkin is a fixed income portfolio manager with Cabot Money Management. In other words, he advises his clients on what debt they should buy, which means he's got a front row seat to the freak show in the credit markets.
2 weeks ago, it was like, you know, I was in the hurricane zone, you know, 15 minutes before it's going to land. There just was nobody around. It was a ghost town.
Now he says the market is filling up slowly. He says it's at about a quarter of its normal capacity. So does the thawing of the credit markets have anything to do with the election?
It's a voting mechanism because everybody votes with their money. And the election is a small piece of it. But it really has to do with the foreign central banks more than who's president of the United States.
Bruce McCain agrees. He's a chief investment strategist at KeyCorp. He says direct injection of cash into banks and loan guarantees from governments around the world have brought interest rates down for borrowers. But
they're not back to normal. They're just trending in that direction.
Guy Laba is a fixed income strategist at Janney Montgomery Scott. He says investors are more interested in the Fed's plan to buy commercial paper and whether more banks will unravel.
And moreover, there's no indication that the two candidates are going to do anything drastically different with regard to economic and financial policies that would help to ease this crisis.
And whatever the new president does do probably won't happen until after January 20th. And as we know now, a lot can change in the credit markets in 2 short months. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
The Treasury Department has been watching those improving credit markets and trying to adapt its $700 billion rescue plan accordingly. The original idea, to buy bad assets from banks, has largely been set aside. Instead, Secretary Paulson's looking at doing more of Plan B, buying stock in financial companies beyond banks. That is a quicker way to get capital into the financial system, although our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports not everybody thinks it's necessarily the best idea.
So far, the Treasury Department has bought $163 billion worth of equity in 35 banks and insurance companies. The cash infusion has improved the flow of credit, so now Treasury is considering more capital injections in a broader category of private companies, including car financing firms like GMAC or Ford Motor Credit. Scott Talbot at the bank lobbying group the Financial Services Roundtable likes that idea.
They have a direct lending relationship with the consumer. If you pick out your car and then go next door to the finance department and those credit departments are unable or unwilling to lend to you, you can't buy the car. So that shuts down the process.
But critics say there aren't enough restrictions on how banks use taxpayers' investments. Plus, existing shareholders complain that when the government buys a stake in private companies, their shares lose value, and they have to stand in line behind the government to claim assets when things go wrong. The Cato Institute's Jagadish Gokhale says the Treasury Department's changing strategy is self-defeating.
Markets hate uncertainty, and so the knee-jerk type of policy that the current Treasury Secretary and his team have undertaken have actually exacerbated that uncertainty, and so I'm quite skeptical.
Treasury still has more than $80 billion left to spend before asking Congress for more. Hundreds of banks are still in line for help. And chances are the next administration will be making changes of its own. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Tens of millions of people are going to tune in tonight to watch the end of what feels like the longest political contest ever. The campaign, though, has been a bonanza for the networks, cable and otherwise. Record ad spending, record ratings. But now that the party's over, television could be in for a heck of a hangover, as Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
The presidential election has been a giant ATM machine for TV networks. There was all that ad money from the extra-long Democratic primary and the extra-contentious presidential campaign.
What's happened to John McCain?
Barack Obama and domestic terrorist Bill Ayers.
Evan Tracy is with the Campaign Media Analysis Group. He says the election has been worth about $2.5 billion in TV ads alone.
It's probably the closest thing to a stimulus package the broadcasters can expect to get this year, and it's been a TV-driven election.
It's also been a ratings goldmine. Nearly 70 million people watched Sarah Palin debate Joe Biden. Obama's acceptance speech in Denver drew a bigger audience than the American Idol finale. Rick Edmonds is a media analyst with the Poynter Institute.
Cable networks do well when they can ride a big story for a long time, and they'll come a lot bigger than this.
Primetime viewership for MSNBC is up more than 80% this year. At CNN, it's up more than 165%. So what happens when the election's finally over? Media economist Jack Meyer says the networks will try hard to hang on to new viewers, but it won't be easy.
Whether audiences will stay tuned to CNN, MSNBC, and Fox News post-election. I think that's the biggest unknown.
Meyer says viewers may stick around for a while to see what the new administration does. After that, the networks might have to hope for a little news, West Coast style.
Britney goes ballistic.
In Los Angeles, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Biggest Election Day rally in 24 years today, even as oil spiked more than $6.50. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Businesses across the country were offering some special incentives today, not to bump up sales, although that probably would have been a nice side benefit. No, they were trying to encourage more of us to vote. Some of the freebies in exchange for a ballot stub out there: star-shaped donuts, a scoop of ice cream, free beer in Baltimore, free tattoo removal in Dallas. All well and good, but commentator and lawyer Carlos Concepcion says businesses have something even more valuable to offer to the democratic process.
A colleague recently asked if I would be willing to be a hero for democracy. What does it entail, I asked. It's simple, she said. I want you to allow a couple of your employees to train to become Miami-Dade County poll workers and work the polls on Election Day. But you need to pay them the usual way, as if they had been at work. I thought about it for about 2 seconds and said, okay, sign me up. Why pay employees to take time off from the work to assist voters? Because poll worker service, like jury duty, is the highest form of civic service. Poll workers do not work for political parties or candidates. They take an oath to leave their political opinions and partisan leanings at home. A poll worker serves all the voters of our community to make sure they can exercise their right to vote. Given all the confusing changes in voter technology, business owners, and particularly attorneys like me, have an even greater responsibility to contribute to the electoral process because our employee pool has a wealth of valuable skills. My firm specializes in commercial litigation and financial services, so our employees are accustomed to multitasking, deadlines, and a high-pressure environment. We have talented workers who read and speak 3 or 4 languages, energetic people who are accustomed to dealing with the public, people who are computer literate and technology savvy. These are precisely the people who make the best poll workers. While most business owners and attorneys I know would tell you that they can't afford to have their valued talent take the day off, if you push a little harder, they will also say that they owe their business success to their community. Many of us owe this country a right to vote. So, my friends, it's time to do your duty. Share your employees. Be a hero for democracy.
Carlos Concepcion is an attorney in Miami. If you'd like to make a contribution to the public debate, send us your opinions. Go to marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Once the electoral dust settles in Washington, Congress and the new president are going to sit down and try to figure out what to do about the economy. Already there's talk of a second stimulus package. Probably not one, though, that's going to put more money directly in taxpayers' pockets. More than likely, it'll be a government spending plan to create new jobs and drive economic growth that way. Eric Jansen is the founder of iTulip.com. He's also the author of an article in the most recent Harper's Magazine in which he calls for a broad reindustrialization of the American economy. Eric, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
What are the steps to this reindustrialization?
We need to start top down with an objective to, say, reduce the energy intensity of our economy by 50% over the next 10 years. So it has to lower the energy intensity of our economy so that we don't need to spend as much money on oil and other kinds of other forms of fuel. And we also have to increase the efficiency of our economy so that goods and services and people are moved around at a lower cost. So, for example, instead of saying, well, let's borrow a few hundred billion dollars and write a check to everybody so they can make one last trip to the Home Depot, take that money and use it to invest in broadband access to every home so that every homeowner and household is now more efficient as a participant in the U.S. economy.
When you say reindustrialize, then, do you mean improve the infrastructure in this country or get it back to where it was 50, 40 years ago, where we were the manufacturing and industrial engine of the world?
Well, industry is different today than it was then. U.S. industry, modern industry, is Google. Modern industry is also the most efficient vehicles that can be used to move people around in this country. And that also includes public transportation. So it's an investment in efficiency. It's in a reduction of subsidies to industries that do not improve our competitive position in the world, such as property. And it's a complete focus on reinforcing our core competencies as a nation to make us more competitive.
But, of course, that takes money in and of itself.
One of the challenges is where is the money going to come from? Because we're already spending, as you've probably noticed, hundreds of billions of dollars on bailouts of financial institutions, $95 billion in tax credits to try to restart our old automobile industry. And what we have to be mindful of is if we continue down this ad hoc path, we're going to find ourselves years down the road without really significant basic improvements in our nation's competitiveness, but we're going to find ourselves saddled with a lot of debt.
Let me get your sense of the financial system as it works in this country today and how that might lead or help get us to some kind of reindustrialization that you've been talking about.
One of the strengths of our financial system is that it's extremely creative, and it's gotten us into a bit of trouble. Creativity and banking, as we have found out recently, don't always go well together. On the other hand, creativity in financing is going to really help us over the next 5 or 10 years to figure out how to fund these projects.
So what's it going to take to make this happen?
It's going to take strong leadership. If we have leadership in this country that is thinking in terms of making long-term investments in our nation's competitiveness, then all the other steps of logic follow from that. If there are simply politically expedient ad hoc responses to the crisis that we're in, then we are going to wind up in an even worse position than we're in today.
Eric Jansen is the founder and CEO of iTulip.com. Mr. Jansen, thanks a lot for your time.
My pleasure, Kai.
With the economy all topsy-turvy, we've been asking around to find out, what are you doing? A lot of people are changing how they manage their money right now. And we've been hearing from some of those people here and on the other Marketplace programs. Today, a church leader in the Midwest who's applying faith to his finances.
My name is Don Vandosky, and I live in Greenwood, Indiana, and started a ministry at our church, and it's a way to apply God's word as it relates to our finances. The reason why church and finances go together is in the Bible, there's over 2,300 verses that somehow describe our handling of money, possessions, and things. the rich rules over the poor and the borrower becomes the lender's slave. You know, just the fundamental in the Bible, it's not a sin to be in debt, but it advises against being in debt. And I think what we're seeing, that kind of coming home to roost. This financial peace class is really a way to encourage people to get out of debt. It's a seven-step plan at the last step to build wealth and also to give. So in terms of what I'm doing maybe a little bit differently is my wife and I are on a cash basis on a lot of our discretionary spending, and so we have a budget for that. And once you get through spending the amount allocated for that, then we stop. What's stayed the same is the faith. That's the stability that helps through these rough times.
Don Vandosky teaches financial peace at Mount Pleasant Christian Church in Greenwood, Indiana. Coming up, when it's too expensive to get sick.
You're at the stage in life where you absolutely need your health insurance, and yet it's the one thing you really can't afford.
But first, let's do the numbers. Normally election days are a little more, well, normal, as with many things on Wall Street. The Dow's winning margin today, 305 points, better than 3.25%. Blue chips closed at 9,625. The NASDAQ checked in with a gain of 53 points, 3.1%, wrapped up at 1780. The S&P 500 emerged with the biggest vote of confidence, picked up 39 points, more than 4%, to finish at 1,005. 1,005, back over 1,000. The buzz may be that the worst is over for helping boost financial share stocks, and Goldman Sachs rang up more than 6.5% today. Shares of Citigroup, Merrill Lynch, and Morgan Stanley all climbed around 5%. Bank of America stock rose 4%. J.P. Morgan shares finished up 3.5% today. Signs of recovery in the credit markets means less demand for safe U.S. assets. The dollar fell almost 2.5% against the euro today. That's the most since the European currency was launched back in 1999. Short-term Treasury prices also dipped more as investors elected to go after higher returns. The cost of the 10-year T-note rose. On the other hand, that lowered the yield to 3.73%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 888-VANGUARD. And by Clarkson Potter, publishers of The Splendid Table's How to Eat Supper, a holiday gift idea for people who love to eat. Now available at splendidtable.org. Want more from Marketplace's special Fallout coverage? It's all on our website. You'll find special podcasts, explainers, and videos. Go to marketplace.org.
Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. The National Farmers Union, the AFL-CIO, and many other groups call news conferences to discuss the election results. Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee meets to consider interest rates. And on this day in 1947, the television news program Meet the Press made its debut. One of the first guests? Franklin Roosevelt's Postmaster General. I'm Caitlin Carroll.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
Time to have a look at what happens when listeners actually do go to our website and click on that link that says Contact. Last week, we told you about a possible merger between Chrysler and General Motors. GM says it needs help from the government to the tune of $10 billion to make that deal happen, and GM says save both companies. The White House has been equally clear that the money is just not coming. A lot of you wrote to point out that while American car companies are pressured to provide pensions and benefits to their employees and retirees, many of their foreign competitors get those benefits from their governments. Roger Anderson from Endwell, New York, says, quote, "It's a wonder U.S. automakers can even exist under these unfair conditions." On the other hand, Michelle St. Germain from Long Beach, California, wants to remember the people on the receiving end of those benefits.
My friend's 80-year-old parents just lost their GM health care provided through their retirement. Who's going to provide health insurance to two 80-year-olds?
There have been a lot of comparisons to the Great Depression thrown around out there, and that has generated some comments. John Crawford from Livingston Manor, New York, offered some history.
Don't worry if we have another Great Depression, for it was the Depression in the 30s that provided such wonderful education for those going to technical high schools. You ask how? All those wonderful engineers and scientists who lost their jobs instead went into teaching at public schools because there were no jobs, at least not until World War II started to really kick in.
Speaking of jobs, a lot of you didn't like last week's installment of our series, Working. We gave you a profile of a pirate off the coast of Indonesia. A lot of you like Lawrence Cruz from right here in Los Angeles.
Piracy is not a job. It was a feat of access to find this pirate, but to listen to him was sickening, given the violence that some of these guys, and maybe this one, perpetrate.
And finally, Tinkerbell. We did a piece about Disney's new fairy brand, and some of you observed that Tinkerbell's reputation isn't all that pristine. In fact, she plotted to kill Wendy in the classic story of Peter Pan. Amanda Haymaker from Rockford, Illinois, offered a better role model.
Girl Scouts have been empowering brownies for almost 100 years with friendship and self-esteem-building activities. And taking millions out of our pockets, replacing our cash not with pixie dust, but thin mints.
If you've got a comment about our coverage or magical pixie dust for the economy, go to our website, that's marketplace.org, and click on that link that says Contact. Once the economy is taken care of, whoever wins tonight gets to move on to his own priorities. The war in Iraq, global warming maybe, immigration perhaps, or health care. While we don't know yet exactly how health care might change, we do know a couple of things about a key part of the health care industry. After years of hefty profits, Big Pharma is growing at a measly 1 or 2% annually, partly because patents on some top-earning drugs are about to expire, but also partly because of the economy and Americans who can't afford to fill prescriptions anymore. Ashley Milne-Tite reports now on making cuts where it hurts.
Julia Koponik lives outside Portland, Oregon. She's overseeing her daughter Sarah's after-school snack.
Okay, I'm finishing your apple, sweetie.
This one's too big.
You may cut it into two pieces.
Okay. She has three children and another one on the way. She's having a tough pregnancy. She's racked up thousands of dollars in out-of-pocket costs for ER visits and hospital stays, even though she has insurance. And her family's used up their savings. She and her husband recently sold their house at a big loss. Now the company where he works is being sold, and his job could be in jeopardy.
There are several of my medications that we've just decided that we're just not going to get filled right now because they're not directly related to the medical problems with the pregnancy. And certainly it's, you know, more comfortable to not have heartburn, but the co-payments for some of those medications are pretty high, and we just don't have the money in our budget to do that.
Koponik says her husband's also putting off dental work he needs. All this sounds familiar to Dr. Ted Eppley. He's president of the American Academy of Family Physicians. He says since the economy started to sour, Americans have been going without more than medications.
We've seen a definite decrement in patients' visits, and we've seen patients cancel appointments, not getting as many tests.
John Haas is one of those patients. He and his wife run a financial consulting firm in Central Florida. Both are in their 50s. In February, they lost their biggest client. Haas says they had a choice, drop their $1,500 a month health insurance policy or go out of business.
And it was one of those things that I looked at and said, you know, I really don't want to do this. You're at the stage in life where you absolutely need your health insurance, and yet it's the one thing you really can't afford.
Haas is on about 12 drugs for ailments including arthritis, colitis, and bronchial problems. Or rather, he was. Since he cancelled his insurance, he's cut his prescriptions in half. He's dropped his colitis medication altogether because it costs $400 a month. He's getting generic versions of some other drugs. They cost $10 to $12 for a few months' supply at Walgreens or Walmart. He's also negotiated with some of his doctors to lower his fee.
And then, of course, you beg for samples. So it helps offset you know, the other expenses that you run into. And then forget about preventative medicine. That's no longer on the table.
Haas says he's skipping some of his annual cancer screenings and blood tests. People with a lot of health problems like Haas may suffer during a bad economy, but in general, Americans tend to be healthier during a downturn. Christopher Room is an economics professor at the University of North Carolina. He's done several studies on health during hard times. He says fewer people die from heart attacks and heart disease during an economic slump. He says people change their lifestyles when money's tight.
They drink less, they smoke less, they're less likely to be obese, so they actually exercise more.
Room admits plenty of people do badly in tough times, especially if they have no insurance. But others take better care of themselves, he says, because they finally have the time to concentrate on their health. He says if that happens this time around, it will be one good thing to come out of the recession. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Gather.com. If it's happening in the world, it's being discussed on Gather. You can join the conversation at Gather.com. By Cleveland Clinic, committed to providing health and wellness services through its executive health program at clevelandclinic.org/executive health. And by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at Putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
Two final notes today, a bonus election edition. First, in keeping with charging more for just about everything, U.S. Airways is saying that on top of those checked bag fees and the $2 soft drinks, you will now have to pay $7 for a pillow and a blanket should you be cold or tired. The airline promises there is a silver lining. They say the onboard bedding is higher quality than the old stuff was. Also, you get to keep it. And now for more spirituality to go along with the secular economy. Nobody, not even the Vatican, is immune from a downturn. We told you this past summer the Holy See ran a deficit last year because of bad bets in the currency markets. Now the Italian newspaper La Stampa is reporting that for the first time in almost 50 years, Vatican employees, that is clergy and civilians, are going to have to start clocking in and out of work. New magnetic ID cards for everybody, the whole thing. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Tuesday. Today, the Dow rose 305.75%, the biggest election day rally since 1984 when they started trading during presidential elections. The NASDAQ added 53.3%. The S&P 500 gained 39 points. That is 4% there. Thanks to Jennifer Collins, Renita Jablonski, and Doug Krisner on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by John Buckley. Coming up next time on this program, on the day after, what is your vision of the future?
I hope for peace of mind. That's what I'm hoping for. I think that's what we have to get back to.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow after you vote.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.